Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
The waves lapped against the boat, water slapping against the tightly bound reeds as it rocked in the gentle current. Braced against the boat's movement, the pair of fishermen worked as a team to cast their nets into the cool depths of the Pacific. The cotton fibers, woven together with expert skill, touched down on the water. It was October, late spring, along the arid coastline south of the equator. The shoals of sardines were plentiful at this time of the year, teeming in their millions beneath the deep blue surface. The seabirds cawed, circling above in their dozens as they too looked to snag their fill from the ocean's bounty. A few hours' work filled the reed boat, three times the height of a person, with the day's catch. Thousands upon thousands of the tiny fish ready to be eaten back on land. The fishermen paddled back toward the shore, taking in the sight of the dry brown hills rising above the beach. It almost never rained here in the shadow of the snow-capped Andes Mountains, visible from the tops of those nearby hills, but that didn't make this a bad place to live. Far from it. The boat slid through the waves, heading toward the mouth of a small river that snakes down through the hills to empty into the Pacific. The fishermen paddled toward a mound that jutted noticeably above its banks a little way inland. The smoke of cook fires rose upward from the mound, a massive construction composed of millions upon millions of shells deposited over hundreds of years. For the fishermen, it was home. Jumping out into the water, their colorfully dyed cotton clothing soaking wet, the fishermen pushed their heavily laden boat onto the edge of the river. One part of their work was done, but the other was just beginning. They would eat some of the sardines now, but more would be smoked or salted, taken upriver or over the hills to the communities of farmers who lived higher up in the mountains. They grew the cotton that the fishermen wove into nets and the beans that supplemented their diet. In return, the farmers got fish and shellfish, invaluable protein to add to the beans and sweet potatoes that grew high up in their mountain valleys. Some of those communities of farmers were going further, gathering together in towns or even cities, building huge monuments of earth and stone. All of them built on this delicate interplay between the shore and the mountains. 6,000 years ago, people on the fringes of the Andes Mountains were building some of the world's first cities and some of its largest buildings. And the Pacific coast of South America was just one place in these two continents bursting with the possibilities of a changing world. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. Only a few places in the world produced the independent invention of agriculture. The Fertile Crescent, the Yangtze and Yellow River Valleys, New Guinea, and West Africa all produced complexes of domesticated plants and animals that shape our present diets, economies, and ways of life. In the Americas, the ancient inhabitants invented farming in no fewer than three places: Mesoamerica, the Andes, and Eastern North America. And almost certainly a fourth, Amazonia. Maize, the world's most widely produced crop by weight, avocado, the topping for toast that disapproving op-ed columnists love to mock quote-unquote spoiled millennials for eating, the chili peppers that make Thai cuisine so fiery and delicious, the potatoes we eat in the form of French fries that, distilled, give us vodka, the sweet potatoes I slice up and bake for my kids every week. All of these things were cultivated, domesticated, and spread by the indigenous inhabitants of the Americas thousands of years ago. In our last episode, we talked about what happened between the appearance of the first hunter-gatherers in the Americas and the early experiments with food production and plant domestication. In North America, that involved bison hunting on the Great Plains and gradual adaptations to the emerging woodland environment in the eastern part of the continent. In one particular corner of this world, stretching from what's now Missouri and Arkansas east to Illinois, Tennessee, and Kentucky, people began to experiment with cultivating squash, sunflower, marsh elder, and a few other plants more than 5,000 years ago. This was the Eastern Agricultural Complex, one of the world's primary centers of agricultural innovation. Far to the south in the Andes, potato, quinoa, sweet potato, guinea pigs, llamas, and alpacas were among the many things early farmers started to domesticate. They did so in conjunction with the massive exploitation of maritime resources like fish and shellfish, as we saw at the beginning of today's episode. The tropical forests of Amazonia provided yet another complex of cultivated plants, especially tree species. By the time Europeans arrived a few centuries ago, the Amazon was less a wild landscape than a vast series of environments shaped to a greater or lesser degree by thousands of years of its inhabitants' intentional actions. But let's start in between the two continents, in Mesoamerica. It was here that one of the most important New World crops, maize, was domesticated, and from where it spread throughout the Americas. Compared to other domesticated plants, maize is shockingly complicated. It's because its wild ancestor, the grass teosinte, doesn't look much like today's big cobs overflowing with large kernels. Teosinte, by contrast, has tiny little cobs with small kernels that don't stay on the stalks waiting to be harvested. For a long time, scholars argued over whether teosinte even was maize's wild ancestor, at least until genetic sequencing put that particular question to rest. The upshot is that the journey from teosinte to domesticated maize was long and winding, much more so than from wild wheat, millet, and rice to their present-day counterparts. Narrowing down precisely when and where this journey began, and what paths it took, and when it became something that we can actually call maize, as opposed to something in between maize and wild teosinte, is really surprisingly difficult. We talked a little bit about that process last time. The short version, practically every detail of which is in dispute among specialists, is this. Teosinte was probably first domesticated in or around the Balsas River Valley of southern Mexico, a tropical region. One rock shelter in the region, a place called Zihuatochtla, has 9,000-year-old evidence of surprisingly modern-looking microscopic maize grains stuck on grinding tools. But there's no evidence of permanent settlement. The people grinding and eating that modern-looking maize, or diverging teosinte, must have been pretty mobile. They probably traveled around the Balsas River Valley, planting teosinte slash maize in one place, processing it nearby at a rock shelter along with some squash, then traveling to another location where they hunted small game or gathered avocados or some other food resource. They would have had a regular round of travel through their range, picking up different foods in different places and staying in much the same camps year after year. But if the Balsas River Valley is indeed where teosinte took its first tentative steps toward becoming maize, it didn't stay there for long. The evidence from Zihuatochtla is extremely early. Maybe more will appear of comparable antiquity before long. But for now, we have to wait until 5600 BC, more than 1,000 years later, and travel more than 1,000 miles south to Panama. That's where we next see evidence of very early maize, followed a few hundred years after that by maize pollen at the site of San Andres, near the coast of the Gulf of Mexico and Tabasco. That's one of the fascinating things about maize when we compare it to other early domesticated crops. In the Fertile Crescent, the areas of really dense early cultivation went along with a shift to sedentary lifestyles and enormous population growth. In East Asia, sedentism probably preceded large-scale cultivation, but it accompanied population growth, again, quite near the place where these wild-growing plants were turned into domesticates. But that doesn't seem to be the case here, not really. Villages, for example, don't appear in Mesoamerica until somewhere around 2000 BC. And that's despite maize being one of only a whole series of viable domesticates in Mesoamerica, like Cucurbita pepo, the squash species that gives us both zucchini and pumpkin, whole variety of beans, chili peppers, chocolate, avocados, tree gourds, and cotton. In the rest of the world, that complex of new innovations seems to have given rise to dramatic social, cultural, and economic change. But in Mesoamerica, while we do see some population growth, we don't see the shocking, enormous population growth, the demic diffusion, as a result of pioneering new methods of food cultivation. That's where a surplus of people carried their whole way of life as a package into new territories. Instead, to the extent that we can see these processes from a much sparser archaeological record, the domesticated crop itself traveled, sometimes over incredibly long distances. We already saw maize showing up along the Tabasco coast of eastern Mexico, even before that in Panama, far to the southeast. Mesoamerica only underwent the kinds of changes we associate with widespread shifts to food production later, starting around 4,500 or even 4,000 years ago. But once those transformations began, Mesoamerica moved really, really fast, from agricultural villages to complex societies to full-blown states in just a few centuries. Those were processes that took millennia elsewhere in the world. In fact, those transformations, once they began, may actually have been a result of maize's return from elsewhere. People took early maize out of Mesoamerica, where it had taken its first steps from teosinte to becoming a staple grain, and brought it south, first to Panama by about 5600 BC, and then still further south into the northernmost reaches of South America. Its transformations didn't stop as it traveled, very much the opposite. People kept experimenting, they kept selecting for desirable traits like more and bigger kernels and bigger cobs. There's actually fascinating and brand new evidence from December of 2020 to suggest that maize actually became the crop we now know in South America, not in what's now Mexico. Only later did it eventually return to Mesoamerica and, in the process, help to jumpstart social and economic transformations in its original homeland. This speaks to one of the things I mentioned in our last episode. We can see the initial migrations, the early peopling of the Americas, but it's really hard for us to catch glimpses of later population movements and transfers of technology and knowledge, like how to grow maize. Thanks to recent archaeological work and new techniques for identifying and dating plant remains, we're just now starting to see how complicated the story of maize, and the story of the people who grew and consumed it, really is. So let's follow maize south. Thanks to a 2011 study by the paleobotanist Dolores Paperno, we have a detailed record of the track the crop followed, when and where it showed up south of its homeland in Mexico. The Agua Dulce rock shelter in Panama gives us evidence of maize from around 5600 BC, where it joined a series of other cultivated plants, squash, arrowroot, bottle gourd, and manioc, all of them native to the neotropical forests of central and northern South America. Other sites throughout Panama give us similar dates and varieties of plant food. Due south of there, along the Pacific coastlines of Colombia and Ecuador, we see dates right around then, maybe a bit later, after about 5000 BC. Maize was probably following the coast, and people seem to have been planting it in the fertile, welcoming river valleys that flowed down from the northern reaches of the Andes Mountains into the Pacific. The toolkits of the people living in this region speak to their use of plant foods. We see more and more ground stone tools, like finely made hoes, heavy axes used for clearing trees, and grinding stones for processing tubers and grain. At the same time as maize was moving south, perhaps a little later, it was also heading east, over the mountains, into the vast tropical forests, savannas, and marshes of Amazonia. We have a strong tendency to see Amazonia as an untamed wilderness, sparsely populated by groups of wandering foragers. There's increasing evidence that wasn't the case by the time Europeans arrived in the Americas. Instead, Amazonia was home to a variety of complex societies with cities, high-level political organizations, whose traces we're just now beginning to uncover centuries later. That past of complexity, including unique ways of shaping the landscape and producing food, began even before maize first made its way south from Panama into the northern reaches of South America. The most recent review of the evidence tells us that people living in the mountain forests of Colombia, on the edge of Amazonia, were already experimenting with food production at a shockingly early date, more than 11,500 years ago, maybe the earliest examples of this in the Americas. Now, this early date looks less surprising than it did a few months ago, since right in that area, archaeologists have discovered an absolutely stunning, incredible series of rock art in the Colombian Amazon. It's called the Serranía La Lindosa, mile after mile of impossibly beautiful and detailed pictures painted in red ochre on the walls of a cliff. The most striking images are those of now-extinct Pleistocene megafauna, which the people presumably hunted, but there are also birds, lizards, handprints, geometric designs, and human figures. Tens of thousands of images painted between 12,600 and 11,800 years ago. Some of them are so high on the cliff that researchers had to use drones to get pictures and video of them. The artists must have used ladders or wooden towers specifically built for the purpose. The people who painted those unbelievable images, or their near descendants, were also experimenting with some of the earliest plant cultivation in the Americas. It's probably not a coincidence that right around this time, the region was undergoing serious environmental shifts from open savanna, scrub, and forest to the tropical rainforest we know today. The megafauna and other animals they were used to hunting would have been going extinct or at least shifting their ranges. The plant foods they habitually consumed might have becoming less available too. In that context, cultivating tubers like yams, tree fruits like avocado, and palms made a lot of sense. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, there's good reason to consider Amazonia one of the independent world centers of plant domestication and food production. Now, what might this have looked like? We probably need to abandon our preconceptions of what agriculture looks like. Permanent villages, orderly fields of crops, and so on. Instead, we should think in terms of cultivated gardens with a variety of plants all growing together. Yams and manioc with their tubers growing below ground, squashes and later maize, all growing underneath a canopy created by a variety of fruit trees and palms. These cultivators tended their gardens, but they didn't necessarily require constant attention. Folks might leave the area for weeks or months to pursue another food source. As people moved around, though, pursuing a broad-spectrum subsistence strategy, they brought their gardens with them. They planted their tubers and their groves of edible fruit trees and palms. Some of what we think of as the Amazon's hyper-dominant species might originally have been spread by these early colonizers, like the acai palm. The garden model of cultivation is probably more likely to be the rule than the exception when it comes to agriculture in the tropics. It wasn't just used in the Colombian Amazon, but also to the north toward Panama and southern Mexico, and south toward Ecuador and Peru. The same model likely applies to early cultivation in eastern North America as well. Aside from the sheer diversity of food sources that this model of agriculture offers, it also provides opportunities for something unexpected: hybridization. Peanuts, which were domesticated on the fringes of southwestern Amazonia, were probably originally a hybrid of different nut species brought together in a garden like this. The same is true for the most widely cultivated variety of cactus in Mesoamerica and several other common plants. As it moved south into northern South America and into Amazonia, maize encountered people who were already doing incredibly creative things with a whole variety of different cultivated plants. Maize joined their gardens, and those people did the same thing to their new crop that they'd done to manioc, palm, yams, squashes, and other species. They improved it. They selected the traits they liked, and they tried to make them more common. This was a process that lasted thousands of years, but eventually, maize would return from South America to its Mesoamerican homeland, ready to act as a staple grain for permanent communities of full-blown farmers. To the west in the Andes, maize played a slightly different role. There, where the Pacific Ocean met the vertical mountain peaks, people had already developed some inventive ways of living in the landscape. Soon, with maize and other crops, they would come together to build complex societies.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
In our last episode on the Americas, we talked about the verticality of Andean civilization, how people use the possibilities and work around the limitations of the various altitudes and landscapes that are available to them. The strip of land nearest the ocean is effectively a hot desert where very little grows except around river mouths. But it offers immediate access to the riches of fish, marine mammals, and plant life growing just offshore. The Quechua zone, by contrast, from 7,000 to 11,500 feet in elevation, has cooler temperatures and more abundant rainfall. Those conditions allow for the cultivation of potatoes, quinoa, and squashes, among other things. The Andes are habitable in different ways at each distinct elevation, but exploiting all of them simultaneously makes this an incredibly productive and viable place to live. Because of the ocean currents running close to the shoreline, one of the richest in the world, people had already settled down in permanent or semi-permanent settlements along the Pacific coast even before agriculture became a key part of their subsistence. This was true of the Chinchorro people we talked about last time, the first people in the world, as far as we know, to intentionally mummify their dead. They lived in what's now the south of Peru and north of Chile. They were dedicated coastal folks. They drew their sustenance from fish, shellfish, and seaweed. But they lived in permanent settlements after about 5800 BC. To the north of the Chinchorro, along the coasts of Peru, Ecuador, and Colombia, people were trying different things. they would eventually combine coastal resources with farming at various altitudes, permanent settlements, and then later monumental buildings, shared set of political and religious traditions, cities, what's often known in both the scholarship and popular discourse as quote-unquote civilization. Let's start with the ocean and what it offered, because there's no understanding what eventually happened in the Andes without it. Back in the 1970s, a scholar named M.E. Mosley wrote a book called The Maritime Foundations of Andean Civilization, which has had a profound effect on how people view the early inhabitants of the Andes ever since. Basically, Mosley's argument is that the offshore fisheries along the coast of Peru were so rich in food resources that they allowed for sedentary living, huge population growth, large settlements, and complex societies that eventually produced monumental architecture and some of the world's first states. Now, why is this compelling and interesting? Well, because pretty much everywhere else in the world, intensive agriculture was a necessary precondition for social complexity. You couldn't have craft specializations, social hierarchies, a variety of settlement types, each of them doing different things, big public buildings, and the like without farming. Or so the older argument went. Now, over the course of our episodes on prehistory, we know that that's not true. There are so many exceptions, like the Jomon or indigenous Americans in the Pacific Northwest, that the rule has all the consistency of Swiss cheese, if it applies at all. Mosley was one of the first to systematically demonstrate that you didn't have to have agriculture. But Mosley wasn't entirely correct. Maritime resources alone were not, in fact, enough to produce complex societies along the Andean coast. The advanced cultures that eventually emerged, building monumental architecture and large settlements, also relied on a whole variety of food crops. Now, to his credit, Mosley did understand the importance of agriculture. It's not like that was invisible in his formulation. But on top of that, as we talked about with the Chinchorro and even prior Andean cultures before that, we now know that people had been fishing and gathering shellfish and generally partaking in the richness of that Pacific current for millennia, from the very earliest days that people lived along the South American coast. So if that richness was always there, why did it take so long for complex societies to develop at all? And why didn't complex societies develop in the spots along the coast that were closest to the richest fisheries of all, along the southern coast of Peru, where people had been living and thriving for millennia? Those are big questions, and the answers are fascinating. As it turns out, there are actually really intimate connections between maritime resources, the growth of agriculture, and the emergence of complex societies. A quick note for this section, I'm drawing on a wonderful 2018 article by David Beresford Jones and colleagues entitled Refining the Maritime Foundations of Andean Civilization. The sites of La Yerba, around the mouth of the Rio Ica in southern Peru, show us precisely what we'd expect to see with such an incredible wealth of maritime resources nearby. A huge shell mitten, 600 feet long, more than 15 feet deep, that was occupied for almost 1,000 years between about 5500 BC and 4600 BC. People came to this spot to collect surf clams, to eat fish and kelp, and the occasional guanaco or deer that they hunted on land. They cooked these foods on open hearths, and they stayed out of the wind in temporary shelters that dulled the fierce breeze, maybe made from reeds. Now, they didn't live at the midden permanently, but they did come back over and over, probably seasonally. We see similar patterns of habitation and use in Mesolithic Europe, Jomon Japan, southern China, and along the rivers of eastern North America, a ton of other places where these kinds of resources existed. Now, a short distance away, less than a mile further inland, is another site. It's later than the first, dating from about 4500 BC to 3900 BC. There are shell middens here, too, but they're interspersed with semi-subterranean houses dug down into the earth. Their walls are made from reeds tightly bound together, like the boats we saw back at the beginning. Now, these were permanent dwellings. People lived there in all seasons. They were protected from the elements in their cozy little houses. They buried their dead in among the houses, too. That tends to be a pretty strong sign of permanence. Now, they still ate the shellfish, mollusks, fish, and kelp that they collected from the sea, and the deer and guanaco when they could get them, but they also ate a wider variety of plant foods, some of which were domesticated crops. Lima beans, jack beans, guava, and presumably domesticated guinea pigs were all part of their diet. That hadn't been the case 1,000 years earlier. This village at La Yerba wasn't small, either. Its population was an order of magnitude larger than the seasonal occupation at that shellmen. So, again, this is exactly what we'd expect to see. Intense maritime resource exploitation, population growth, and permanent settlements appearing in a clear sequence over time. This happens all up and down the coast of Peru, from the extreme south, where the Chinchorro lived at roughly the same time, all the way up to the border of Ecuador and beyond. So next, we think we should probably see more and larger settlements, richer burials, bigger buildings reserved for special purposes, not for people to live in, what we call monumental architecture. Again, that's what we see further to the north, in central Peru, for example, the region on which Mosley first based his argument about the maritime origins of Andean civilization. But that doesn't actually happen at La Yerba. Instead, this village was abandoned. There was little sign of further occupation in this region for centuries, either at the coast or inland. To the south, the Chinchorro never took that next step either. Instead, their populations seem to have dropped dramatically right around this time in what we call the mid-Holocene. For reasons that aren't entirely clear, there's also good reason to think that populations in Amazonia, on the other side of the Andes, declined, again dramatically, around this same time. Only further to the north, in central and northern Peru, did these sedentary coastal villages lead to more growth and then into the emergence of complex societies. Why was La Yerba abandoned while groups further north continued to grow and grow? Shouldn't the entire Andean coastline have been home to a thriving series of maritime cultures? The answer Beresford Jones and his colleagues provide to those questions is really compelling. To get to the stage of complex societies, Andean cultures needed to combine all of the resources available at various altitudes, not just what they could get from the ocean with a few domesticated plants. They had to take advantage of the verticality we talked about, and they needed to do so in kind of unexpected ways. In other words, we have to look inland from La Yerba. There's not much there, to be honest. There are some lomas zones along the coast where the fog collects and provides patches of shocking green, but otherwise it's incredibly arid and unproductive. When you look at an aerial map of the region, it's just featureless brown anytime you get away from the rivers. There were only a couple of viable spots nearby, like the village of Pernil Alto, 40 miles away, that was occupied from about 3800 BC, where they grew sweet potato, lima beans, guava, and gourds. So, for the people of La Yerba, the maritime resources were great, but they couldn't be supplemented with a ton of agricultural produce from nearby inland sites. To the south, where the Chinchorro lived, the situation was even less promising. Again, they had the sea, but that was almost entirely it. And the sea wasn't enough. But when we head north into central and northern Peru and look inland, the situation is much different. There were dramatically more abundant terrestrial, meaning land, resources. The people living at the coast could trade their abundant fish and shellfish for things grown at a whole variety of altitudes. They could supplement their diets with beans, sweet potatoes, domesticated animals, and the like. Now, we know that the people at La Yerba did this to the extent they could, but there was a hard limit. And they completely lacked a terrestrial resource that people further to the north utilized to make their fishing even more productive. Cotton. When we've talked about cultivated plants thus far, we've mostly focused on the stuff that people ate. Maize, palm nuts, tubers, like sweet potatoes and manioc, things like that. But plants could be cultivated for all sorts of purposes. Trees for timber, reeds for roofs or baskets or house walls, gourds for containers, flax for clothing, and so on. Now, people weren't eating cotton, which they started domesticating in northern Peru at least as early as 6000 BC, but they were using it for a variety of other purposes. Cotton clothing was comfortable and lightweight, just like it is today. That's probably why people originally started growing it. But for the enterprising fishermen, cotton was a fantastic material for nets. It was quite fine, flexible, and strong. And more important, because cotton could be cultivated, unlike the natural wild-growing bast fibers the La Yerba people used for their nets, there wasn't a hard limit. Fishermen further north could make more and larger nets. But when the bast ran out because the people around La Yerba used too much of it, it couldn't come back. It was not a naturally self-replenishing resource. Fishermen in central and northern Peru, on the other hand, could just grow or trade for more cotton. They could make larger nets. They could easily repair the ones they already had. In other words, cotton could scale in a way that wild fibers could not. As the population grew and more fish were required to feed them, that meant more and larger nets were needed. Cultivated cotton could provide those nets. They could provide more maritime food resources for trade with inland communities and the fuel for still more population growth. More and bigger boats, more and larger nets, both of those things offer the possibility for catching still more fish, especially during the late spring and summer season from October to February, when those fish were at their most abundant close to shore. Once caught, those plentiful sardines and the like could then be smoked or salted for storage. And then, during the less abundant off-season, those fishermen could exploit seasonally available food resources instead of having to go after the fish that were slim pickings at the off-season just to have something to eat. Because of the constraints, that couldn't and didn't happen at La Yerba, but it did further north. And it wasn't just a matter of resources in the strict sense. Increasing the scale of cotton production and fishing meant involving larger groups in the process. It meant building connections within and between communities. It required cooperation. And cooperation, social ties, could operate in many different directions. If you were coming together to trade lots of commodities on a regular basis, well, that opened the door for shared beliefs, institutions, eventually maybe settlement hierarchies and political organization. And that is precisely what we see further north along the Peruvian coast. All of these things came together, the richness of the coast, the food crops grown at various altitudes, including the evolving forms of maize that had arrived from further north, the cotton, the domesticated animals, all of it. And when those things came together, complex societies were the result. What did those cultures look like? If we look at the region called Norte Chico, just to the north of the Lima district in central Peru, we can see one of the first complex societies in the Americas, and what looks like its first city, a place called Caral or Huaraquinga. Six small mounds were built of a material called xicra, reed or cotton bags filled with rock and then piled up to make walls, kind of like sandbags or pea gravel. When they were done with a level, or it collapsed, they filled in the rooms and built another level on top of them, one level built on top of the last in a sequence of occupation lasting for centuries. The spaces in between those six mounds were likewise full of buildings, but it never piled up enough there to form their own mounds. Now, the radiocarbon dates from the tops of these platforms go back to about 3700 BC, which means that the dates at the bottom of the mounds, the beginning of the occupation, must be older, maybe much older. Hundreds and maybe thousands of people lived at Caral at any given time. It was a city, it was a real city. And it wasn't the only such site in the region. There were 17 contemporary inland sites with mounds in the Supe Valley and more in neighboring valleys. While the mounds at Caral may have been built slowly, at other sites they were built quickly and intentionally. They used large amounts of labor. That either implies voluntary collective action or forced labor. In either way, we're talking about complex societies with shared beliefs and structures and institutions, probably societies with leaders. They subsisted on the rich maritime resources available just offshore, supplemented with squash, sweet potatoes, chili peppers, guavas, beans, and of course the industrial crops, cotton and gourd. A small amount of maize has even been found, though the maize may mostly have been for ritual, spiritual offerings. The Norte Chico civilization, as it's known, is early, really early, beginning before 3700 BC, and it lasted for a long time, a couple of millennia. Similar transformations were underway further north. The sites weren't as big, but there were artificial platforms built on hillsides, sunken circular courts, mounds with buildings on top, presumably built by large groups of laborers under the direction of some kind of leader. Whether that was forced leadership or voluntary, the people of the Peruvian coast had obviously crossed some sort of threshold. They were the first people in the Americas we know to have done so. The cultural foundations they laid down, everything from traditions of art to social hierarchies to craft specialization to their specific blend of complex economies, their religious rituals, their forms of monumental architecture, all of that would stick around up to the Inca and even beyond.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Eastern North America is nothing like the Andes. It's heavily wooded, it's laced with rivers, and there are no towering mountains in sight. And yet it too turned into a center of domestication, producing a suite of unique cultivated plants unlike those anywhere else in the world. And in time, complex societies emerged there too. They had their own monumental buildings, mounds, large constructions of earth and other materials that marked special points in the landscape. But the connection between those two phenomena is complex. It's not at all straightforward, if there's any connection at all. It's a good reminder for us that the human past contains multitudes of experiences and ways of living and very few universal processes or sequences. The Eastern Woodlands extends all the way from the edge of the Great Plains to the Atlantic, from the Great Lakes down to the Gulf Coast. That's a huge area, and it's not homogeneous. The Mississippi Delta is a lot different than the headlands of the Ohio River, for example. And, this is important, the environmental conditions weren't stable over the many thousands of years we're talking about here today. In fact, those environmental fluctuations are essential to understanding why the particular form of plant cultivation that grew up in the Eastern Woodlands did so. Now, last time, we talked about some of the ways that people lived in this region after the Clovis hunters and the retreat of the glaciers. Some engaged in huge collective caribou hunts. They modified the landscape with drive lanes built from wood or stone to catch their prey on their annual migration, at least until the caribou moved further north. Others hunted deer and collected nuts in the new forests that grew up as the ice receded. Starting around 6000 BC, a group of people, maybe migrants from further west along the Missouri River, came into the Mid-South in the area around the Ohio and Tennessee rivers. They started to do something a bit different. The rivers in the region were teeming with shellfish, and the new arrivals began returning to the same places along the riverbank year after year to exploit them. Mounds of used shells piled up, mounds that became persistent places in the landscape. The people of the Shell Mound Archaic, as it's called, built shelters on the mounds. They cooked their food in hearths on the mounds, and they even buried their dead in the mounds, even their dogs. These were places that mattered to them, and they were the beginning of the mound-building tradition in this part of the world. That's a tradition that lasted until only a few centuries ago. Kenneth Sassaman, who has written about the Eastern Woodlands in particular and ancient North America more generally, sees the Shell Mound Archaic as fundamentally a diaspora way of life. It arrived from elsewhere in the Mid-South around 6000 BC, and then it dispersed along several different routes at different times. Southeast into the Savannah River Valley between Georgia and South Carolina around 3000 BC, northeast into the Finger Lakes of New York around 2500 BC, then northwest into the Wabash River Valley of Illinois around 1800 BC. The persistent mounds of the Shell Mound Archaic have parallels with the shell rings of the southeastern United States, which are mostly coastal sites. These are circular or horseshoe-shaped mounds, comprised of oyster, clam, whelk, snail, and the like, along with some domestic refuse like cooking pits. They belong to a much different cultural tradition than the Shell Mound Archaic. They occur in different places, but the fact of mound building, that these would have been places that were visible and important in the landscape, that seems relevant. And by the time of that latest dispersal toward the Wabash River Valley of Illinois, other mounds had already appeared in the south in what's now Louisiana. Now, not all mounds are the same. There's a difference between mounds that accumulate over centuries of use, mounds as persistent places, and mounds that are intentionally built, sometimes in weeks or months, by large numbers of people. We saw that distinction among the Norte Chico in Peru a little while ago. The mounds at Caral were gradual constructions, but others at the 17 sites in the Supe Valley had come together very quickly, sometimes in months. Now, the mounds that started to appear in Louisiana after about 4000 BC were built of earth rather than shell. They even predate the Shell Mound Archaic diasporas. But it's hard to see a total lack of connection between these persistent places, these mounds that had already existed for centuries just a few hundred miles away, and the new constructions further south. So what were these new mounds? Well, there were a whole bunch of them. The oldest is now unfortunately destroyed and may have been from as early as 5000 BC. But the rest, and there are a whole bunch of them in Mississippi and Louisiana, all date to between 4050 BC and 3050 BC. Sometimes they appear on their own, but more usually they're a related complex of earthwork constructions. Watson Brake, the largest and best known of the bunch and dating to between 3500 BC and 3000 BC, consists of an oval complex of 11 mounds. The tallest of those mounds is 25 feet high, and the whole complex is more than 900 feet from one end to the other. As far as the archaeologists who excavated the site can tell, the earliest work at Watson Brake was just a small arrangement of burned rock piles on a stream edge. But about 150 years later, people started building much larger mounds. These weren't just monumental things for some one-off ritual. People lived there among the mounds. From the garbage they left behind, we know they ate a lot of fish, deer, and nuts. We know they napped their stone tools and drilled stone beads right there on the site. They were local people using local sources of raw material. They probably occupied small temporary campsites nearby. This does not seem to have been a temporary gathering place for a large, geographically diverse group coming together from all over the place, united by some shared belief. The people who built the mounds lived there through all seasons, not just occasionally. Even if there's no evidence of plant cultivation, these broad-spectrum foragers were at least partially sedentary. Now, interestingly, they did not actually live on the mounds. There's evidence for wooden buildings beneath the mounds, but not on top. The site was probably abandoned from time to time. We can tell because a layer of soil covered an occupation layer before another occupation layer was laid down. But people lived there and kept building the mounds for a long time, at least 500 years and probably longer. For whatever reason, it was a place that people kept coming back to over and over again, adding to their mounds and stages, living their regular lives before moving on and then returning once again. The shell mounds, shell rings, and the earthen mounds like Watson Brake all point toward a much larger scale tradition of mound building to come. About 70 miles east of Watson Brake, built about 1,400 years after Watson Brake was abandoned, lies something incredible, a huge complex of earthworks, much larger than Watson Brake, monumental in size and scope. This is Poverty Point, a UNESCO World Heritage Site that truly deserves the designation. Mound A, the largest mound on the site, stands more than 70 feet tall. It measures 705 by 660 feet in diameter. Low semicircular ridges, concentric rings of them, emanate outward from the big mound. That ring is more than a kilometer across. Other large mounds frame the ridges, and there are several more large mounds nearby to complete the complex, all laid out on the same axis. The whole thing is frankly enormous. It would have taken huge amounts of labor to build. Unlike Watson Brake, where, as far as we can tell, the inhabitants were local folk, Poverty Point was a cosmopolitan place. Presumably hundreds or thousands of people lived there at any given time, maybe more than that, judging by the diversity of raw materials like quartzite from Alabama, chert from southern Illinois, other chert from the Middle Tennessee River, soapstone from southern Appalachia. Copper, shaped into beads and pendants, came from as far away as the Great Lakes. And artifacts like those the people at Poverty Point used show up at sites as much as 100 miles away, even further. So this is a complex society. We see monumental buildings on an enormous scale. We see settlement hierarchies. We see craft specialization. We see long-distance trade networks. People stayed at Poverty Point for a long time, for hundreds of years, before the site was abandoned. What's harder to say is why Poverty Point or the mounds at Watson Brake and elsewhere were built in the first place. Poverty Point may have had something to do with spiritual beliefs about the afterlife, about rejuvenation or renewal. There was obviously something intricate and fully formed at work. This wasn't a half-baked effort. The place was carefully chosen. It sat on trade routes that extended outward for hundreds of miles. Its beliefs were presumably shared over a huge stretch of time and space. Now, more than that is really hard for us to say, but it's a fascinating series of questions. What we know for certain, and how this ties into what we've talked about before, is this. The people who built Poverty Point lived in a world where mounds existed. They saw them, they knew them, they understood them as markers in the landscape. And even if their reasons for building them were different from the people who had come before, they still built their own. But the people who lived at Poverty Point and Watson Brake before it were not farmers. There is absolutely no evidence for domesticated plants at either site. There are none at all. Instead, these people were broad-spectrum foragers. They ate nuts, fish, shellfish, deer, tortoises, small game, and so on. That's a familiar diet. It's one that looks comparable to what we've seen elsewhere in the world. And it's the kind of diet that characterizes most of this period, going back to the beginning of the Holocene throughout the Eastern Woodlands region. The period that saw the appearance of the Shell Mound Archaic and Watson Brake had mostly favorable conditions. Shellfish were abundant, so were acorns and hickory nuts in the expanding forest, and so were the animals that fed on those nuts, like deer. But it's a little more complicated than that. Dr. Shane Miller, a Tides listener and a specialist on this period who gave me absolutely indispensable help with the research for these two episodes, wrote a book about this period. The environmental conditions are essential to understanding population dynamics. When times were good and people could focus on the really high-quality food resources, populations boomed. That's when we see the shellfish mounds start to accumulate, storage pits for nuts to last throughout the winter, and so on. People changed their subsistence strategies to match the abundance. But those good times didn't last forever. Climatic conditions oscillated. When resources grew scarcer, but populations were still high, that's when we see more evidence of conflict. I mentioned the bodies buried in the mounds of the Shell Mound Archaic. Well, many of them show evidence of violence, like broken bones and even scalping. that probably correlates with these periods of environmental pressure that we're talking about. And this is the context in which we should understand the emergence of agriculture in the eastern woodlands, particularly in the Mid-South. There was nowhere else to go, so people had to get creative in finding caloric resources in the regions that they already had access to. That meant more grinding tools and the development of pottery for cooking, but it also encouraged folks to start thinking about how to make use of plants that may not have looked so good before. Some of those plants we recognize, like squash. Nothing wrong with squash. We know that people were eating domesticated forms of squash all across the Americas by this time. Sunflower is another. It'd be a less straightforward food source, but it still makes sense. But what about maygrass, chenopod, marsh elder, or erect knotweed? Those are harder for us to wrap our heads around, but that's exactly what people living in this region did. They intentionally cultivated these fast-growing weeds. They selected for desirable traits and eventually varieties that were different enough from their wild counterparts to appear domesticated show up in the archaeological record. This is what's known as the Eastern Agricultural Complex, and it's a suite of domesticates unlike any other in the world. Precisely how people used this suite of domesticates also probably differs a bit from what we've seen elsewhere. These were fast-growing but relatively low-return foods. They were best suited to use as part of a continuing broad-spectrum subsistence strategy. You didn't just eat knotweed or maygrass. Instead, they would have been part of a diet that included fish, shellfish, deer, hickory nuts, acorns, and so on. These plants would have been cultivated in small gardens, maybe not even tended regularly. In response to changing environmental conditions, people living in the eastern woodlands simply developed innovative ways of dealing with those shifts, of adjusting to the booms and busts in the availability of the foods that they wanted to eat. So here in the eastern woodlands, we've seen the last of our emergences of agriculture in the Americas, the fourth and most idiosyncratic of all the ones we've discussed. Sedentism and permanent occupation came before the Eastern Agricultural Complex. Monumental building of the mounds in the south was, as far as we can tell, essentially unconnected to it. Here, we can see the sheer diversity of ways people could live, how societies could change over time, the many directions they could take. There was no single package of cultural evolution from simplicity to complexity. Even within just two of the world's continents, places connected to one another by Mesoamerica and the Isthmus of Panama, we can see a staggering variety of ways to live in a changing and challenging world. The mound builders of Hopewell and Cahokia, the giant stone heads of the Olmec, the managed forests of Amazonia, the mummies and cities and temples of the Andes. All of them were in the future. All of them complex societies arrived at via their own distinctive paths. Eventually, maize would bind them together. It would return to Mesoamerica from South America. It would spread into the American Southwest, then east into the woodlands. But those days were far, far ahead. For now, the Americas were a patchwork of innovative ways of living in a staggering array of different landscapes. Next time on Tides of History, we'll leave the Americas behind. We're heading back to the Near East for the first time since the Natufians, to Mesopotamia and Egypt, to what's colloquially known as the cradle of civilization. Here, we'll see the emergence of what are conventionally considered the world's first states, the first confirmed instances of writing, cities, and much, much more. Until then, thanks for joining me. If you'd like to see some visuals of the things I've talked about today, go to patrickwyman.substack.com. That's patrickwyman.substack.com, where I'm posting pictures and videos in a post to go along with each episode. I also write essays on current events and historical perspective, but feel free to skip those if you just want the prehistory. Again, that's patrickwyman.substack.com. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman, on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA, or on Instagram at @Wyman_Patrick. You can follow the show on those platforms at Tides History. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this show right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen early and ad-free. And if you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left us a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound designed by Molly Bach. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by the incredible Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know business.